I don't know if you've ever heard this before. I don't remember where I picked it up, but there's this thing that directors are supposed to do when an actor nails an audition. You're supposed to turn to your casting director and you're supposed to say to them, get that person in makeup. And it's sort of a vestige from the studio system when, you know, actors would come in and audition. And if they were great, whatever movie was shooting at the time on the lot, you would just run them down into makeup, hit them with a thing of powder and put them in front of a camera, right? Like the idea being they're that good. And after Piper was done, I turned to my casting director and I said, get her in makeup.
Hello, and welcome back to The Director's Cut, brought to you by the Directors Guild of America. In this episode, a woman is terrorized by her childhood imaginary friend in director Jeff Wadlow's mystery horror, Imaginary. The film follows Jessica, whose daughter develops an eerie attachment to a stuffed bear they find in the basement of her childhood home. What begins as innocent games quickly becomes sinister, as they realize that the bear is much more than just a stuffed toy. In addition to Imaginary, Wadlow's other directorial credits include the feature films The Curse of Bridge Hollow, Fantasy Island, Truth or Dare, Kick-Ass 2, and Cry Wolf, and episodes of the series Are You Afraid of the Dark? And Agent X. Following a screening of the film at the DGA Theater in Los Angeles, Wadlow spoke with director Ari Sandell about filming Imaginary. Listen on for their spoiler-filled conversation.
Hello, and thank you for coming. I guess we'll do just so you know, my name is Ari Sandell. I'm also a member of the DGA. I'm a director. I happen to be good friends with Jeff Wadlow, and he asked me if I would moderate it. So it's, of course, my honor. I guess we'll just jump in with some questions that I have. I come from the comedy genre, so the horror thriller genre is not my bag, but I do enjoy watching it and trying to learn it and try to understand it. So I guess the first thing I would ask is just talk a little bit about how did you get involved in the project? What the germination of it was? How did it come to be?
Yeah. So after I made Truth or Dare and Fantasy Island for Blumhouse, Jason Blum signed me to a first look deal and he challenged me to make a classic Blumhouse movie, the kind of movie they made in the early days of the company, which usually involved a smaller budget and a family kind of moving into a house. There's a bump in the night, that kind of thing. And so I wanted to make a movie about an imaginary friend because I like playing subjectivity with the audience. I experimented with that in my first film because that was about a group of kids who lied for fun. And then my co-writers, Greg Erb and Jason Ormlin, I'd invited them to come in and talk about some ideas for Blumhouse. And they brought me this idea of a scary teddy bear named Chauncey. And it sort of felt like all three could coalesce, and they did, and into the screenplay for Imaginary.
So what's the writing process of it as far as like how long did it take to get a first draft, and how long does it take to go from the draft to actually shooting? And then what is your involvement in it?
Yeah. So the first draft was pretty quick, and we actually were marveling the other day at how many of the ideas from just our initial brainstorming never changed. You know, it was always a teddy bear. It was always the story of a blended family, two daughters, the nosy neighbor, Gloria, the therapist scene was, you know, a note card that we first put up there in the early days of brainstorming. This idea, we're going to get into some spoilers, obviously, this idea that Jessica would find herself trapped in the imaginary world at the kind of all is lost moment. That was always there from the very beginning. And so the first draft happened very quickly, but then, you know, we got stuck in development hell as movies do. And it was probably, the pandemic certainly slowed things down. I'd say it was probably a good 2 or 3 years then before we actually got to make the movie. Yeah, no, it took some time.
Okay. And talk a little bit about, one of the biggest hurdles in this is working with a young kid. So talk a little about how did you cast her? What's that like? What's your process?
Yeah. I mean,
how old is she, by the way?
Piper is 10 years old. Okay. but she looks like she's about 7 or 8, in my opinion. Casting that role was difficult. I mean, we saw hundreds, if not thousands, of actresses. We looked in Los Angeles, New York, Atlanta, New Orleans, Canada, Chicago, the Blumhouse casting department. They're always casting movies. So they had, you know, files and files of little kids already because they had just cast Five Nights at Freddy's. And I couldn't find anyone. I really started to despair. I thought I was going to have to do that thing that directors do where you kind of build a performance, you know, you kind of help with the line reading, you know, you're going to cut up a lot of different takes and you really kind of just craft it on the set. And you know, in editorial, it's going to be a lot of work. And I thought that's where I was going to end up. And then Piper walked through the door and I'd seen her tape and I thought she was good. And I was like, bring her in. And the casting department was like, well, she's on this Nickelodeon show. They're probably not going to release her. I was like, oh, let's see her anyway. She came in and she just crushed it. I've never seen anything like it. The second scene was the first scene was the therapist scene. I don't even remember what the second scene was, but she came in. She said, do you mind if I do the therapist scene last? Because I'm going to cry and I'm kind of an ugly crier. And I said, sure, Piper, we can do whatever you want. And she said, okay. And then afterwards, I'm going to tell a joke just to lighten the mood in the room. And I said, okay, sure, that sounds great. And she had her sides on like a little iPad with like this colorful plastic case. And she started on that first scene that was not the therapist scene. And I realized she had the wrong sides. And normally if you say to an actor, oh, wait, stop, you have the wrong sides, they just melt. They just crumble on the spot. And they're like, I don't know what to do now. And I said, oh, Piper, those are actually not the right sides. Did they not send you the correct sides? And she was like, she looked at me and she said, well, these are the sides I have. I said, okay, well, then we'll do those sides. And then she did the therapist scene. And I can tell you right now, it was as good in that audition as it is in the movie. Wow. One take, just crushed it. Absolutely crushed it. And there, I don't know if you've ever heard this before. I don't remember where I picked it up, but there's this thing that directors are supposed to do when an actor nails an audition. You're supposed to turn to your casting director and you're supposed to say to them, get that person in makeup. And it's sort of a vestige from the studio system when, you know, actors would come in and audition. And if they were great, whatever movie was shooting at the time on the lot, you would just run them down into makeup, hit them with a thing of powder and put them in front of a camera, right? Like the idea being they're that good. And after Piper was done, I turned to my casting director and said, get her in makeup.
So when you're working with her, what's the process? Because, you know, every actor has their own process. Then you have kids. That's a different thing. And there are own hurdles in just dealing with, do you rehearse with them ahead of time? How many takes do you have that you can do with her before she's kind of worked out in a scene? Plus you're limited. What are the hours that you can work?
Yeah, no, hours are very limited. There's a lot of challenges, but I will say this, maybe I've been spoiled, but every child actor I've worked with has been more prepared than the adult actors. I mean, they show up and not only do they know that day's work, they usually know the work for the rest of the week. Like sometimes I'll pull up scenes and I did this TV show, Afraid of the Dark, and it was an ensemble of minors. And I could pull scenes up from like 2 days in the future and they would already be off book because they learned the whole week ahead of time. And Piper was the same way. I mean, man, she knew her stuff and all the actors in our movie knew that they had to be ready to rock when Piper was there. Now, that's the upside. The downside is the hours are limited. You got to make sure they're in school. You have to have photo doubles there to shoot overs in case you lose.
What are the hours for somebody who's
11? Depends on their age.
Yeah,
depends.
So she's 11.
She was 10 when we shot
hours,
it.
5 hours.
Don't get me in trouble. I don't remember. What I would do is I would always say the AD department, you know, put it on a piece of paper and tape it to my monitors. Because right. It's not just when they're done. It's when they got to go to lunch. There's right. All these things you have to hit. I said, just put it on a piece of paper, tape it to my monitors so that as I'm planning my shots and thinking about the time we have left in the day, that I make sure I account for when we lose her. Because there's no negotiation. I mean, it's child labor laws.
Of course. And in rehearsal, I mean, is rehearsal valuable for her? I mean, I've worked with kids and I found that sometimes it was valuable and sometimes it actually would screw things up because the best take I would ever get was the first thing I did in rehearsal. And then I was like, I wish I didn't.
I just, honestly, I never really had her for rehearsal because the hours were so precious.
Right.
The notion of like bringing her to set to rehearse and then sending her away to go to hair and makeup while we're lighting and doing her thing. I always would just say, just send her straight to hair and makeup, get her on set as quickly as possible. Sometimes I would have her ready to shoot for rehearsals, But most of the time I kind of block the scene without her.
So she sounds pretty savvy, but I'm curious, you know, when I walked out of the film the first time, I thought, how do you work with a kid in a movie that is full of scenes that she probably can't, she can't see the end, you know, when it's too scary for her to see, how do you work with her through those scenes?
Well, she had never seen a scary movie before. Our movie was the first scary movie she ever saw.
So she saw the final
product. She did. She came to the premiere. She loved it. She was very happy. Okay. She squealed and covered her eyes a few times. I mean, but here's the thing about scary movies. Again, I mean, I don't know about like Pet Sematary back in the day when that little kid had to cut Fred, was it McMurray? Fred Ward? I can't remember. Had to cut one of the famous Fred's Achilles heel, like how you handle that. But by and large, our movie is a fantasy film. And even if it's scary in the movie, I'm here to tell you, making a scary movie is not scary at all. It's actually quite funny. I mean, there's like guys standing there in rubber suits, like drinking the coffee. It's just sort of an absurd exercise.
And does she make commentary? I mean, what's her experience through this?
She's the queen of the set.
Right.
I mean, and it's actually quite humbling for, DeWanda's great and has no ego. So I don't think she batted an eyelash, but when you have a kid on set, it doesn't matter who is number one on the call sheet. That kid is number one. Right. Like every member of the crew is paying attention to the kid. The kid is just like, you know, full of energy and life, and the crew is just lifted by their spirits usually.
Well, we're at the DGA, so you can talk a little bit about just film related stuff and just talk about pre-production and what that was like and how many days did you shoot? What was the budget? Where did you shoot? Just some of the...
Yeah. I mean, we shot the movie in New Orleans. It was an incredible experience. We started shooting right after the writer's strike started, and we wrapped right before the actor strike started. So we had the best crew in Louisiana because nobody was working. So it was a really interesting window where we could just get anyone we wanted. So we had an incredible crew. It was a wonderful shoot. It's probably the best production experience of my career. Everyone was just happy to have a job. And they're all really good at their jobs. And DeWanda, who played Jessica, was also an executive producer on the movie. And she was really the only producer on set with me. And she led with such grace and integrity. And it was just the whole thing could not have gone better.
How many days was the shoot?
It's so funny. Like, these are the things you obsess over while you're shooting, but I let go of it so quickly. My recollection is that we shot for 31 days. Yeah, and it was actually a very stage-heavy show. Most Blumhouse movies, you know, you get a real house, and you're rarely on stage because stage is more expensive. But because of all the monsters and the gags and the second, we had to build these two-story sets and sets that could rotate for some of that through the portal stuff. And so we were on set quite a bit. I think we were only on location 2 weeks, and then we were on set for about a little over 4 weeks.
So that brings me to the next topic, which is monster-based. First is typically in the genre, as I understand it, it's usually common knowledge to hold off showing the monster as long as possible, slow reveal, and then maybe at the end. What I thought was interesting is you chose to show it right at the beginning.
Spider.
So, right. Yeah. So you could talk a little bit about that.
And yeah. I mean, but even then with the spider, we tried not to sit on him for too much. I mean, the shots where you really see him, you have the sort of where dad transforms into the spider. And that was a Texas switch, by the way. That was not a VFX shot. That Sam Salary, who plays dad, was sort of there. And then DeWanda wiped the camera. And as she was wiping, Sam leaned back and the actor who was playing the spider leaned in. So that was all in camera, that shot, that transformation. And then the next time you see him is that whip pan. And then you see him when he's kind of like opening the door, but the door is sort of hiding his face. You only really get the full Monty on the spider in those last two shots. And I just wanted that shock. And it was such a cool design. I really wanted to go for it in that first scene.
Yeah. Talk about that, about how did you come up with the design? And, you know, you have multiple monsters. You have the bear, then you have the monster version of the bear, then you have the spider itself. And I think there was also another kind of...
Yeah, the entity is what we call that last character. Yeah, I was really lucky in that I made a monster movie for Netflix and had a huge budget. And so I was able to interview all these different creature houses, and I ended up hiring four different houses. We had so many monsters in that movie. It was called The Curse of Bridge Hollow. But one of the creature houses that really impressed me was Spectral Motion, which was founded by Mike Elizade. It's Guillermo del Toro's creature shop of choice. They do a lot of James Gunn stuff too. And I invited them to come do the whole movie, and they're incredibly talented artists and So it was just, you know, a process where it's very iterative. You just do a lot of different versions of each creature, and I keep giving notes. We go back and forth, and we work obviously in 2D at first, and then they get into 3D modeling. And then once a design is approved, they build it and make sure it works.
Is any of this CG, or this is all?
So my preferred approach is what I call sort of a practical CG hybrid approach, where it's, I always want something practical, something real on the set. I think the audience can feel the reality of it. They can see how light is interacting with it. They can see that it's obeying the laws of physics. It just gives it a verisimilitude, which helps them with their suspension of disbelief. And it also really helps the actors because they have something real to react to, as opposed to just like a tennis ball on a stick. But audiences are savvy. If you just have a guy in a bear suit, they're going to know it's just a guy in a bear suit. And so you have to find little things you can do with VFX to kind of augment and heighten. For example, on the bear beast, we gave him a dog leg in the wide shots. So he has a sort of backwards knee, which is not achievable with a real person. And the other thing we did, which was probably more noticeable, was his tongue, and all the saliva was CG. So he's got real animatronics in his face, moving his eyes. I mean, there's four puppeteers off camera puppeteering the features on that bear monster. Even the mouth, the guy in the suit isn't controlling the mouth. But then when you see his tongue sort of swish around, that's VFX.
And are you pre-vising a lot of this stuff and doing like preparatory storyboarding? I mean, how intense?
It would be nice to have the budget to do a pre-vis. We did not on this movie, but I do a lot of storyboarding. I found this amazing storyboard artist in Vancouver who I've never met. I've only talked to her on Zoom, but she's done my last three movies. She's so incredibly gifted. She understands lenses and shot composition. Most storyboard artists are kind of comic book artists, and they don't really understand how cameras represent reality. Whereas she gets it, man, and she is so fast. It's pretty amazing. My assistant always enjoyed it because I would get on Zoom with her and we would just fight. We would fight nonstop about like the 180 degree rule. I'd be like, no, you broke the line. She'd be like, what are you talking about? I was like, no, we have to go this close up from this side. She's like, that doesn't make any sense. And we would just sort of argue like this old married couple. But her storyboards are outstanding, and I love that she challenges me. In fact, the reason why the spider is on the ceiling in the end of the movie, I have that one shot where we tilt up and we see the spider. Nobody in production wanted me to do that shot. They're like, oh, it's going to be so expensive and difficult. We got to get a guy on the ceiling, blah, blah, blah. But it was because Wendy, my storyboard artist, she's like, dude, you have a spider in your movie and the spider's never on a wall or a ceiling. That doesn't make any sense. It's such a wasted opportunity. I'm like, okay, we're putting the spider on the ceiling. And you know how we actually did it? Instead of putting the guy on a rig and getting him up there, we actually just shot him on the floor as a plate. And my brilliant costume designer made a second coat, and they put a wire hanger in the coat. So it looks like the coat is like pointing at the ceiling, right? When he was just on the floor, we shot it and then we flipped the image. So it looked like he was on the ceiling and his coat was hanging down.
I have to go back and look.
It's a pretty quick shot, I'm not gonna lie.
I guess, you know, what's a favorite part of the film that you're really proud of? What's maybe a favorite part what was a favorite part to shoot versus what was a favorite part to watch? Because sometimes the favorite part to watch was the biggest pain in your ass.
I mean, favorite part to shoot is tough. I don't know how you feel about your movies. I feel like everything is difficult, right? So when people ask me like, what was your favorite scene to shoot? I was like, the scene that was done. I mean, it's hard work making a movie. So I rarely feel like I'm like rocking out and having a good time. You know, I'm sweating every detail. So
I feel like sometimes there's every now and then there's a time you walk on set and you look around and maybe you step on set, it's the morning, you're having coffee and you're like, and you look around and you're like, holy shit, I'm on a movie. This is amazing.
Yeah.
Every now and then it
hits
you.
That Never Ever set was pretty cool. We built a lot of the Never Ever. Most of the Never Ever is, if it looks, like we couldn't have built it just because it's a set extension, but all those doors and all those corners, we built a pretty complex set for that. And that was pretty cool. That was pretty cool, certainly. But again, I probably had a moment of like, oh, this is cool. Oh my God, how are we going to make our day? So it didn't last long. My favorite scene to watch. I really love our cast. And so when there's great performance beats, that's when I probably enjoy it the most. as someone just watching the film, because ultimately, you know, that's your actor's gift to you. I mean, you can't make them do that. I mean, it's, you can help guide them and talk about like the end result and maybe give them some tools, or maybe help them understand the scene a little better. But ultimately, the analogy I always use, it's like, I just feel like the coach on the sideline, like you can't make them throw the ball, right? Like they got to be able to do that on their own. So I really enjoy the moments when they just nail it. I think DeWanda in her scene where she's talking about her past to the bed and she thinks Alice is under the covers and the bed sort of moves. I mean, that's a really wonderful emotional scene. And for her to be able to go to that place emotionally and then be ripped out of it when she realizes it's not Alice, and to do that take after take after take is very challenging. But then also that therapist scene with Piper playing Alice is just amazing. I mean, I call that the primal fear scene because I think it's sort of reminiscent of what Ed Norton did in that movie with Richard Gere, the way she's able just to play the bear, play herself. I mean, actually the best version of that scene is probably the table read, because when we did the table read on Zoom, Piper actually read Alice and Chauncey and was just going back and forth. And it was insane. Yeah. So insane, but you did it beautifully.
I guess you could talk a little bit more about just any of the other casting and what that experience was. It seemed like the nanny felt a little bit like you were, was it the nanny or was it the therapist, who seemed like you were kind of almost going for the Poltergeist, the woman in Poltergeist kind of feel,
a little bit, yeah.
that guide through what's happening.
Yeah.
So I don't need to talk a little bit about casting.
I mean, the way I approach casting is I always cast actors who surprise me, who do something different that wasn't on the page. I also, the way I think about casting is I don't cast the character, I cast the person. So I'm not looking for the character. I'm looking for someone to come in the room who is way more interesting than anything I could have ever imagined and has all these layers. And I look at them, I think, oh, that's the person who should be in this movie. And very quickly, I forget about the character. In fact, I often will start calling the characters by the actor's name, which makes everyone very confused, especially the ADs. But yeah, they just sort of blend in my mind very quickly. So an example of that would be Veronica Falcone, who played Dr. Soto. Actually, the therapist had a different name. We changed it to Soto once we cast Veronica because obviously of her background. Originally, she was sort of written as kind of this matronly sort of grandma character, just to have a take on the character on the page. But what Veronica did with the character was far more interesting, giving her this like gravitas and this real strength. You know, DeWanda Wise, who plays Jessica, really just does an amazing job in the movie. And you know, making a movie in the South with a black female lead, I mean, you have to be aware of any sort of cultural landmines. But at the same time, I wasn't making a movie about the black experience. So I had a lot of talks with DeWanda about that because I just wanted to tell the story that we were trying to tell. But we also had to be authentic in the depiction of Jessica, because even though she wasn't written as a black female character, once I cast DeWanda, I cast the person. So she was at that point. And really, DeWanda was a tremendous partner. She worked on the character's backstory. And we talked a lot about her relationship with her mother and her grandmother, all these things that you don't see on screen, but inform choices that are made. The last two actors, three actors I should talk about quickly. Betty Buckley, the legendary, iconic Betty Buckley, who, you know, played she originated the role of Grisabella in Cats on Broadway, the first person to sing the song Memories. She was the first actor I cast because she emailed Jason Blum and said, "Hey, Jason, do you have a role for me in a movie?" And he forwarded me the email. He's like, can Betty play Gloria?" And I was like, "Absolutely. Will Betty play Gloria?" was my question. Tom Payne from The Walking Dead, who plays Max, the husband. Again, because this was a Blumhouse movie and the budget was tight, I was told, just find some local actor. It's not a big part. We don't have the money to fly them in and put them up. I was like, we're supposed to believe this guy is married to DeWanda Wise, one of the most beautiful actresses working today. There isn't some like part-time actor in New Orleans who's going to be able to carry that water. And so fortunately, Tom Payne had just had a general at Blumhouse. He was excited to be in business with them. So he came down and was more than game to play with us. And the last actor I want to talk about is Tegan Burns, who played Taylor in the movie. she's so good in the movie. I mean, that's a hard role to play, the kind of the bitchy little stepdaughter who ultimately has to kind of become the action hero of the movie. You know, she saves Jessica in the end. And the producers were like, you have to hire an 18-year-old. You have to hire an 18-year-old. We already have this little girl playing Alice. Hours are going to be very limited. It's going to be hard to make our days. Please, please, please cast an 18-year-old. And Tegan read on her 16th birthday. And I was like, boom, she's got the job. She's too good. And they're like, are you kidding me? I said, I'm sorry. I do everything I can to make our lives easier, but sometimes you got to make the right choice for the movie. And she was the right choice for the movie.
Yes, I was going to just say, any questions from the audience? The question is, what was the budget?
I mean, look.
Are you not allowed to say?
I can say. I mean, we play lots of, in the filmmaking industry, we play lots of games with the budget, with like tax rebates and where we're shooting, and is it the net budget? Is it the gross budget? The final budget was about $10 million. But again, this is a Blumhouse movie, so all the actors are getting scale. There's like no overhead. Jason doesn't take a fee. I was the only other like producer besides Jason. I don't get a producing fee. So it's pretty lean and mean. We did, yes.
Well, the question is, did you get incentives in Louisiana? Sorry, I have to repeat everything because for the recording.
Yes, we did get incentives in Louisiana. We're super grateful to the state of Louisiana, and I'd go back in a heartbeat.
Do you prefer, I mean, if you're going to pick a place to shoot as far as outside of LA, Louisiana versus Atlanta versus Toronto versus...
Atlanta is kind of overshot at this point. I've shot two movies there now, and it's just hard to get locations. Everyone's very production savvy. They want a lot of money just to like use the parking lot. Every location that you can shoot has been shot at this point in Atlanta. Right. I'm even on the second time I was there, they were showing me locations I'd seen on my first movie. I was like, I can't shoot the same house. And so even though I love Atlanta, I'm very grateful to the state of Georgia for their incentives. It's a little hard to shoot there now. And also there's so many things shooting there that it's hard to get a good crew. Right. Whereas what was great about Louisiana is I had the best crew I could have possibly asked for.
Any other questions from anyone? Anything? No. All right. Should we head into the lightning round here of just a quick answers? You ready?
All right, let's go.
All right, here we go. Favorite part of the filmmaking process, is it pre-production, production, or post-production? You have to pick one.
Whatever I'm not doing in that moment.
Hardest part of the filmmaking process?
Production for sure.
Interesting. Favorite location that you shot in on this movie?
The Never Ever set.
Scene in this film that you are the most proud of?
Oh, I would say the scene in the nursing home when they all have the teddy bear eyes on. DeWanda's performance is so good, getting those actors in, because those were real prosthetic eyes. That was not CG. They couldn't see a thing with those eyes on. So what we had to do is we had to block the scene. They had these like sort of flesh colored kind of collars, I guess you'd call them, on their eyes where they blended into their skin. Everyone came down. It took them like 3 hours to get those on. Then we would block the scene. They would sort of memorize where they were walking. And then right when we were ready to roll, I'd say, okay, pop the teddy bear eyes in. They put them in and they're basically doing those scenes blindfolded.
Interesting. All right. Three more. The scene in this film that you wish you could do it again, if you had a chance. It's an honest question.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Scene I wish I could do again.
Or just anything you wish you could do now that you, knowing what you know now, you might have done it differently.
Knowing what I know now, I think maybe it's so hard because you have to let go of your mistakes. Otherwise, you can't finish the film and stay sane. I think maybe that the finale in the basement, the struggle with the entity was very difficult because everyone's like on their stomachs on the ground and getting those shots is hard. And I hate the way his fingers look. They're kind of rubbery. I would probably want another crack at that scene. Okay. I missed a tie-in shot that I wish I'd gotten with Alice so you understood where she was in the room.
Your preferred thing to eat on the set in the morning? Go.
Same breakfast every day. I have egg whites, turkey bacon, and veggies.
Very healthy. And then last, what is your most common go-to snack at crab service?
I actually have a rule that, not a rule, maybe it's more of like a suspicion or a belief. I don't know. You tell me. But I try to learn everyone's name on the crew except the people who work at Craft Services. And if I finish a movie and I know the people who worked at Craft Services, I went to Craft Services too many times.
All right, fair. Anybody else?
The house was in Metairie, and the reason why I picked that house was I wanted to make sure it didn't have like a Southern Gothic look, because we were trying to stay away from that whole aspect of Louisiana. Because originally the script was supposed to take place in Connecticut. And I actually, another rule, this is actually a rule. If I can, I'd never say the movie takes place somewhere other than where I'm shooting, because it's such a pain in the butt to like if we had said it was Connecticut, there's all these palm trees on that road. Like we'd have to VFX out the palm trees, or I can't shoot down the road because I'm looking at palm trees. It's so much easier. And also you're running around changing license plates and doing all this stupid stuff that the audience, what's that? Yeah. The audience doesn't even know you did all this hard work to fool them into thinking it's Connecticut. Who cares? Like make it Louisiana. So I made it Louisiana, but we picked that house because it was close enough to the stage that I didn't need trucks. So we saved a ton of money on this movie by not having a whole base camp when we were on location. We'd basically get everyone ready at the stage and just jump in vans and then go to the house.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Well done.
Thank you. Thank you for
my pleasure.
The questions. It was, I would say well done as well.
Okay. Well, let's go have a drink.
Done.
Thanks for listening to another DGA Q&A. The Director's Cut is available wherever you listen to podcasts. And please share, subscribe, rate, and review. We'd love to hear your feedback, and you can help fellow film buffs find the show. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time. This podcast is produced by the Directors Guild of America.